Welcome to Tear Gas and Gumdrops, the podcast dedicated to helping people in ministry and mission bring scriptural truths and theological ideals into complex world of day-to-day life. I am Chris Morton, coming to you from Austin, Texas.
I am Kyle Sapp, coming to you from Antioch, California.
All right, let's go. Kyle, are you excited about Apple Watch?
I don't even know what that is, Chris.
Okay, so the new Apple wearable technology.
From yesterday. The Apple Watch.
Yeah. Okay. So I don't know when this will be out there, but yesterday was the Apple announcement.
Yeah. No. I know about the Apple Watch. I thought Apple Watch was some kind of like thing. We're actually watching Apple for something that's
What's
about
to happen.
Because I was confused. Like, I thought they did all their announcement yesterday. What would we be watching for now? Apple Watch 2015.
Yeah, what did you think? Would you want one?
No. not even at alls.
Yeah. You know, there were two main things I thought. It's like, here's one more thing I have to charge. That was the first thing.
Probably not have the charger. It probably won't have the charger that I have. I'll have to buy a whole new charger.
Right. No, it does. It has a nice little round charger to fit it for because it's a... and then the other thing I thought was, I'm just ADD enough on my own.
Right?
Right. And I have enough problem, like, checking my phone. I don't need to be checking my phone and my watch.
Yep. I concur.
But I also kind of feel like maybe that's also just me being, like, coming up with an excuse because, like, I'll never be one of the cool kids, so I'm going to hate the cool kids. You know, just like, well, your thing is stupid anyway. Because I just can't.
Apple's stupid. Apple's hipster.
Apple's for stupid hipster. Yeah, I just, because I
your
don't.
Trimmed glasses and your tea in fun winter shapes on the phone.
Did you see the Apple scarf guy?
No.
Apparently there was this dude during the keynote who they had, like, doing a presentation. And he's, like, you know, our age, late 20s, early 30s, and he's got awesome, like, Hanson hair. Like, he was a grown-up member of the band looking that never cut his hair. And then one of those infinity scarves. Do you know what I'm talking about? It's just this large... Yeah. Effeminate scarf that doesn't seem to... Anyway, it was amazing. Yeah. And he was, like, demonstrating his watch with his ginormous scarf that was bigger than anything except his big hair. Anyway, so those were my two big takeaways. I can never afford the watch, but maybe I can afford the scarf. But
watches as it is, so why do I fancier thing that I'm not
exactly,
going to wear?
Exactly. Didn't you... Oh, I got a segue. Are you ready for this? I remember you saying that you, like, bombed a youth ministry job interview once because you didn't have a watch. And you were, like, called out at some old school church because they asked you where your watch was.
That's not me.
That wasn't you.
That wasn't me.
I can see that happening in certain circles, though.
So. Sure, I'm surprised that wasn't...
Whoever didn't have a watch.
That guy didn't have a watch. He kept looking at his phone sides.
But, yeah, well, so today, man, I hope I can get these edited and out there soon, because if not, like, that whole Apple Watch thing is going to be so dated. Like, people are going to be looking at their Apple Watch wondering why we're talking about it. But
they're going to be watching right. on their Apple Watch. Your mother is going to be like, oh, Christopher, you're so outdated. The Apple Watch has been around for 6 months.
I like that my mother sounds like she's from some, like, late Buster Keaton talkie movie.
yeah, and that's my old lady voice / 1920s detective.
Awesome. Well, so segueing, today we're going to talk about Kyle and his youth ministry and why he's still at it, because you've been at it for 8 or 9 years professionally now. Mm-hmm. Doing it in, but honestly, like, you were pretty active at it in college, I remember. So coming on a decade of sorts, if you include a volunteer time of youth ministry, and a lot of, I don't know that you've decided that you're a lifer, But you've definitely outlasted a lot of youth ministers. And we talked about this a little bit in another episode. But really, so I came up with a title for this episode, which is Why Kyle is Still Passionate About Youth Ministry. So maybe we should start by making sure, Kyle, are you still passionate about youth ministry?
I am, at least this week.
Hooray. Hooray.
If you don't get these out soon enough, who knows?
Right. They'll be looking at their Apple Watch Gen 2 and be like, what?
Right, he's Kyle. A preacher.
Yeah. He's a challenger.
Same thing.
Yeah. So, okay, well, let's start with this. Because I want to know how you've changed in this, but how would you define youth ministry? Like, what to you is youth ministry?
I guess youth ministry is the practice and the theologizing of helping adolescents connect with the risen Lord and Savior. I think that's a pretty simple definition.
That's good. That's good. And how did you, how do you land on that definition? Why do you like that definition?
Well, I like it for a couple of reasons. One, I like it because I said it. Two, it turns theology into a participle, right? Theologizing.
Participle?
I think so. Anyway. Because I think a lot of people view youth ministry like they used to in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. Not youth ministry professionals. I think people who think about youth ministry don't think about it that way, but a lot of parents still kind of have that concept in their head.
Okay.
And it's just fun games and, you know, getting kids baptized and going to retreats and whatnot. And I think youth ministry is more about helping students think about God and about how God interacts with the world, and it's putting those thoughts into practice. And I would probably add families in there somewhere.
Okay.
So adolescents and their families, because you don't, for the most part, I don't think you have a very strong and grounded faith development unless there's family involvement in some way. It's not the only factor by any means, but I think it's an important part of the equation. And that may be not just necessarily blood family, but, or not nuclear family, I should say, but aunts, uncles,
yeah.
Fellow church members, other adults, so that we broaden what it means to be family anyway and reorient ourselves to that concept.
Wow. You're talking about a much broader definition than, how can we get these kids dunked, as we probably say in tradition you and I came out, or how we get these kids saved, as they'd say in other traditions. You're talking about something much more inclusive, in that it has to happen in a larger group of people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, maybe you were hinting at this a little bit, but do you think you've changed your definition of youth ministry?
Yeah, definitely. I think the fact that I can even put that into words is a change in and of itself. It's okay. Like, what do you, if you would ask me when I was 23, what do you do? I've been like, I tell people about Jesus, and I want teenagers to, have fun and be in relationship with Christ, and
right.
He's nifty. And if anything, I've used, smarter sounding words.
Well, that's good. That's what master's degrees are for.
Exactly. That's what we get master's degrees, so we can overcomplicate things and right. Multi-syllabic words.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think just in practice things have changed too. I was having a conversation with somebody trying to start a young adult ministry, and one of the ways I've changed over the years is I don't see myself as the buddy and as the goofball that everyone loves and wants to play or laugh at.
Yeah.
That I see myself as an authority figure, but not in an authoritative way, but as an influencer.
Okay.
And I take that seriously, that what I get to do on a regular basis is be a positive influence in young people's lives and in the lives of their families.
Yeah.
And I don't think I thought about the family unit as much as I do now, and how the family unit shapes and how the family unit can be shaped by by God's word and by the church as a whole.
Yeah.
In the early days, but I do that more now. Probably not in big, broad, awesome ways that some of my friends are doing it, because they're just frankly better youth ministers than I am. But I value it more. I value family more, not just their families, but also value my family more. I value my rest time more.
Yeah. Well, okay, that's probably worth pushing into right there, because as you were talking, I was kind of wondering, like, how much of this is the fact that, you know, since the times that you and I were going to college together, a couple of major things have changed. One is that you have a wife. And more recently, that you have a baby.
You have a haircut.
I need a better one. But haircuts aside, because I guess what you're saying is you have the same haircut.
No, I shaved my head years ago and just kept it that way.
Cheap. Exactly. Yeah. But okay. So how then? Let's push on that a little more. How do you think having a family yourself has affected your understanding of youth ministry? I know you kind of hinted at it, but or maybe if there are any like stories that went with that where you're like, oh man, this has got to change.
I think I knew there. I don't think about like one specific moment where I had some kind of great revelation for how things needed to change. From the very beginning, I did know that I was getting married, and I was marrying the lady that I was dating when I started the job.
Mm-hmm.
And so even from the very beginning, I wanted to make sure I had boundaries in place so that I wasn't always just with the kids.
Right.
Like, I was never that, for better or for worse, I was never that classic youth minister that was young and every night I was out with students.
Yeah.
I never had that. Because I always felt like that would make her introduction into the church harder, her and for me. And so I early on, I set out to have boundaries. And those boundaries still changed, and they had to change, but mm-hmm. but it wasn't as a dramatic shift.
But you were aware of it. You were aware that it was going to be a need.
Yeah. And then in regards to Isaac, it was kind of a similar. It was kind of a similar thing, only even more so. Whereas without the baby, I felt perfectly fine having being gone 3 or 4 weekends in a row, or you know, 2 or 3. And since he's been around, I've really tried to slow that down to being, you know, to limiting myself to having an event one weekend in the month, and then maybe, you know, another weekend, but not feeling the pressure of having to be gone every weekend, and having to really fight to have weekends with my family and to be okay with that and to not feel guilty or not feel like I'm missing out on some opportunity.
Yeah, I know. I definitely felt that way. So it's a little different now that I'm bivocational rather than full-time. I think when I was full-time, and especially any job that's salaried, but especially with, you know, the call to ministry, just always thinking, man, I should be with one of the kids. I should be developing something, or I should be doing church stuff right now. Or, and that was part of that's probably just me being an extrovert and like always needing to be around people. And maybe I was spiritualizing that, but I really was like very conscious of, what affects people is what happens face to face. And I think I used to feel a lot more than I do now, a guilt that I've got to be for in their faces, creating that change.
Well, and somehow, actually, I think I know where this came from. I came out of college with an unearned chip on my shoulder because I remember I like the emergent movement was huge senior year, and I spent a lot of time reading Tony Jones and Sandra, what's his name, and some of those early
post evangelicals.
Yeah, and in those days, they were really cynical.
Yeah,
and we're kind of in that fresh, I'm burned out and tired.
Yeah,
and so I came out of college with their cynicism
kind
a little bit,
parroting some of that.
Kind of.
Yeah,
I had to really let that go. and in some ways that protected me because it saved me from becoming a spiritual workaholic, which I think most of us want to be without realizing it, that we always have good reasons for living for the kingdom and for doing the quote unquote work of the kingdom. The reality is we're just obsessed with our jobs.
Yeah.
And if we were in an accounting firm or something else, we would still be doing it. And it's just easier to get away with it because now we're doing it in the name of the Lord, right?
Right. We can spiritualize it and feel good about ourselves at night.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think...
I came out of college with that cynicism. That I wanted to be better than that I didn't want to go through those pains and those trials. And so I became... As much as I had boundaries, it was still the only thing I thought about. You know, I still was working 50, 60 hours a week.
Yeah.
On things.
So it maybe did. Are you saying then that it took having the family to actually live out some of those boundaries that you knew were important?
I think so.
Yeah.
And I'm still a workaholic. Like, I'm still a spiritual workaholic. And
right.
The family is a nice way to be tethered.
Yeah.
Which is what, you know, which is one thing I always looked for in a wife, in a girlfriend, was I wanted to marry somebody who wasn't in youth ministry so that I wasn't obsessed with it. Like, it wasn't the only thing I ever did, which I've had varying success with because I do love youth ministry, and right. So it's hard to just always talk about it.
Right.
Like fantasy football.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's like a mini podcast we should have sometime, is like the biggest spiritual thing you could do is get a hobby for a lot of people, especially a lot of people in ministry. But, well, that's good. But, okay, so you're still at it, and you're at it, and it sounds like one of the biggest things that's allowed you to stay at it and maybe kind of keep your passion going is boundaries, even when they're not perfect, at least there's something you're aware of. Why do you think that is? Why do you think, where's that, what's that special thing that happens between boundaries and passion there?
I don't know. I went into this wanting to be a longtime youth minister, and I'm always going to be a youth minister in some capacity.
Yeah.
It's always going to be important to me. It's always a part of who I am. I'm not, even if I ever became a preacher at a church, I would still work in youth ministry in some way. It would still be a part of what I was doing. And so I think, number one, when you commit to doing something long term, you commit to viewing it like a marathon.
Mm-hmm.
And so you learn to say no so that you can say yes.
Yeah.
And so you learn to take a break and to be okay with taking a break and not feeling guilty about taking a break. So that, one, when you take a break, you actually take a break. And two, when you take a break and other people are like, oh, well, you could have done this, or you could have done that. Or when you look at your calendar and you look at your friends' calendars, and I feel like I do this every year, I hear about all the cool things my friends are doing and like my few planned events that are intentional and well-meaning and are well-purposed then grow into like 30. And it's like, because I want to be like them because they're doing cool things. And I have to remind myself that I'm not going to burn out.
Mm-hmm.
And if I do youth ministry in that way, I'm going to burn out. I'm going to burn fast and it'll be bright and brilliant and beautiful, I guess, but it'll be quick and over. And who knows who's going to actually get burned.
Well, and to go back to our previous question, it sounds like one of the things that's changed for you is that you've kind of reevaluated the importance and value of events.
Mm-hmm. And I think youth ministry as a whole has. I mean, all of the people that I read talk about, you know, and it kind of started with the whole purpose-driven youth ministry back in the early 2000s, and that's kind of evolved and grown into people just asking, you know, what is really important, what is really shaping. And one thing that I think is very important for youth ministry, but it's hard to stay focused on, is just the simple fact that you can't produce closeness with God. My preacher said that a few weeks ago at a youth retreat, and I thought it was just, it's Like, you can't produce it. You can't manufacture it. The hardest thing about you know, serving a spirit and serving an unknown, you know, serving God, who's not unknown, but who's, you know, he's not controllable, is that growth and those kinds of things happen on his terms. And while there are things that we certainly can do to become more aware and to grow and to strengthen that awareness, ultimately, I think the spirit does what the spirit wants to do,
mm-hmm.
and events don't kind of force the spirit's hands. Like, yeah. You can have youth rallies that are fun, but don't do anything. Then you have to ask yourself, why did I just spend the last, you know, 32 hours at this event that was exhausting? And then, sure, the kids had fun, but they can have fun anywhere and everywhere else. And I'm not opposed to fun, but I want to be intentional about our time together, mm-hmm. and not being like a social calendar planner.
Yeah, no doubt.
And kids don't want to do that stuff anyway, because they would rather just hang out with their friends. And
yeah, and man, I would just, I don't know. So, okay, so with our church plant, we have a decidedly low production value on our Sunday morning gathering. We generally, we'll have at least one major blunder in our visuals and our slides. So we had, this past Sunday, we had an entire song missing. It was our nice closing song, so we didn't have it. So that was our big rally to leave. It was like, Jesus, you know, people just trying to, I've never heard the song before, you know, and we just don't, I mean, I don't think myself, I'm a terribly good looking individual, you know, so people aren't coming to look at me. People aren't coming to look at our slides. We don't have a huge band or anything like that. And it's amazing. Okay. So to give you a little context, in my city, there is a church that was founded by the one single individual who's written the most songs on K-Love. I won't name names, but that's the expectation in Austin. Austin's a music city, and there's churches that reflect that. Man, it feels good. It feels good to not have to try to pull that off. We don't draw the crowds with that. But the people that are there are always saying, man, it's so good to be in a place where we can relax and get to know people and hang out and really hear from God. And I don't say that to toot my own horn or anything, but just to say that there's so much release in not having to put on a good event. And don't get me wrong, I want to get better. I don't ever want to have a missing song again. That was hugely embarrassing. But man, it feels good. It feels mm-hmm. good. And I think that it's affecting our people.
Sure.
Okay, so here's one thing I want to know, just for fun. What's the dumbest thing you've ever done in youth ministry or been a part of?
This was 7 years ago, so I feel okay saying that where people can hear it. When I was like 23, I think, I went out with some friends and I had too much alcohol, and so the next morning I was hungover, and that day we had a water park.
Oof.
Event.
Oh,
I got up at like 6 a.m. to travel back to Antioch. And then I spent like from 9 to 7 p.m. with students. And it's just kind of like okay, you got to suck it up and
head pounding. And
yeah. And it, you know, and I don't even drink that much. I rarely drink, but like I was 23 and I'd found a drink that I really liked. And I just did the dumb 23-year-old thing that I think everyone has at least one of those stories where
yeah.
the first time you discover alcohol, or within the first year, you have that one moment where you forget to be self-controlled, and that happens. That's probably the, I don't know if that's the dumbest thing I've done, but it's the thing I look back and it's the one thing I really shake my head on. It's like,
What's something, this may be too much off the top of your head to come up with, but can you think of anything that you thought was really cool and then didn't work at all? Like, was
pretty much any game I ever play with our students, I always think it's going to be awesome, and it never is. Because apparently I suck at picking games. In 2008, maybe it's 2000, no, it's 2008, we did this youth rally at our church. And we had all the kids on Sunday morning. They were in the main auditorium, and I was talking about the weekend and planning and everything. And at the time, I had really wanted a Wii.
Nintendo Wii.
Nintendo Wii. Mm-hmm. Not the baby form of going to the bathroom. And so I got up Sunday morning and got a Wii. Went to Target. Target finally had some in. They'd been sold out forever. I got one, and I got to church, and I was doing the opening announcements, and I started making this parallel to how I couldn't wait to get a Wii, and I was so anticipating the youth rally. I was like, today God moved, and we got our youth rally, and it was a success, and I finally got my Wii, and I threw my hands up in the air, and like the kids, to their credit, knew to be excited. So a few of them were like clapping and cheering, but the rest of the adults were just like,
what are you talking
about? And like, so that Tuesday, I came into the office, and I was sitting with the preacher and the other minister at the time, and he was just like, yeah, that was stupid. Why did you do that? Yeah, I got too excited. I thought it was going to be really cool, and it just made me look more lame than I already am.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. I've got a few stories like that we'll save for another time. It's classic, though, how something that seemed like such a good idea at the time. And there's probably a particular danger for youth ministers with that mm-hmm. you know, your main audience is, you know, you're trying to relate to them, and their parents might not get it, or you may fail.
Or one time, I had this idea that we were going to raise, our youth group was going to raise money for PUMP, the Portland Urban Mission Program. Mm-hmm. And so the idea was just kids get money and we're going to try to raise $300. So I was doing the smart thing and getting it okayed with my elders, because I was nervous back then about you know, people being mad at my plans. And the elder, without telling me, just announced to the congregation that we were doing this. And I told the teens, if you guys raise $300, I'll shave my head. And this is before I shaved my head. So he announces to the congregation that if we raise $300, I'll shave my head. And it's like, if I'd known you were going to tell the 180 adults who all have jobs that we were trying to raise this money, I would have totally had a high.
Right.
And a dude, one of our members, just walks up to the podium in the middle of the announcement, opens up his wallet, and hands him $300. It's like, well, who walks around with $300 right. in their wallet? I don't understand that. So,
it's like you were set up.
I shaved my head. And it worked out really well, because it became a really good... But I mean, like, I'm a cancer patient bald. But like I got a Bic and like straight... Yeah. Straight shaved all over the place. So I was like super bald.
And you're like, this is not worth $300. I should have gotten a lot higher.
I should have gotten higher, man.
That's awesome.
Because I really like this look now.
Yeah. Well, so to bring it in, what would you say? There's a lot of expectations on youth ministers, like you mentioned before, especially, you know, based on kind of maybe this, I don't know, golden age, heyday understanding of youth ministry. But what do you think is something that youth ministry actually can't do?
Well, I think it can't solve every problem.
Yeah.
You know, it can't fix, you know, it really can't fix our students. It can't force them to follow Jesus. It can give them ways and hoops to jump through so that adults will show them affection and love. And that's kind of the danger of youth ministry, is it just becomes another way that kids learn to learn who is affirmed and who is not affirmed, learn who's in and who's out. And we're really good at doing that. Yeah. We give all attention to the good spiritual kids.
Yeah.
And even all of our attention to the bad, negative, never do anything right kids, and we ignore the kids who are just kind of in between.
Yeah.
But it's really to avoid that system over the last couple of years, and I feel like I do a pretty good job of it. It's a lot easier when you have a group of like 20 kids as opposed to 52.
Right.
So I don't think you can do that. Depending on the research, I don't think it guarantees faith after high school, and I don't think it can.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because students, everybody has that natural transition, and everybody has doubts, and so, you know, no matter how involved students are, and I've known students who were the most passionate and deepest involved in mine or other youth ministry programs, and they get out. And I'm, I mean, these are solid youth ministry programs. I'm not saying mine was solid, but these others that I've seen, solid youth ministry programs, and just across the board, they walk away for, you know, one reason or another. And it's like, if you're looking for youth ministry to solve the American decline in the church, it's not going to happen.
Yeah. Wow. Well, man, that's, you know, we've kind of touched on that a little here and there, and we probably will again. That's probably worth a whole episode in and of itself, is, I won't go too deep into it, but I was talking to a guy and his daughter, his adult daughter, the other day. He came from a more evangelical tradition. She ended up marrying a Methodist, and there was this big pressure over whether or not he was born again. Because of his, you know, because of his background, you know, so there are these churches that have what's called a covenantal theology, right? That the kids are, you know, that's why they baptize babies or sprinkle, is because we're saying we're bringing you into this covenant that your parents are already a part of, and then there are churches that say they practice, you know, where you're. You convert as an adult, a believer's baptism and born again. I think if you really, you know, functionally looked at it, that a lot of these churches that say they practice believer's baptism or say that you have to come to faith on your own, I think functionally their youth ministries kind of work as a more covenantal system, that like you're a part of the church. And I'll go as far as, like, I'm not condemning that, because And I'm not even going to condemn a covenantal system. I don't. It's not for me. But I think that we really need to figure out what our expectation is there. Of what it means to be a kid whose family is involved in church, and what we expect from them, and what we can literally expect of them. I don't know, man.
Well, and I think you have to be careful. I think my language is probably more covenantal.
Yeah.
I think anyone who's a member of our youth group is a member of our church.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know where I'm not really into drawing lines. So whether they're baptized or not, I still think they belong in our church, to our church, or a part of our church. And again, that goes on to whether they're a part of the ontological church or not. that's one of those things that I'm going to just leave up to Jesus.
Right. But we do have to make sure we drop that word in.
Sure, sure. But I think in today's adolescent world, everything is so performance-based.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's actually probably true for all of this world, but particularly in the adolescent world, we're seeing just this high resurgence of focusing on accomplishments and focusing on doing and earning and achieving,
right.
And so much so to the point to where there's very little, if any, slowing and resting and breaking, and that's one of the things that's killing students, just mentally, physically, and spiritually, is that they're always on the go, they're always connected to everything, which is why we shouldn't buy Apple Watches, because we don't need to be connected on our wrists.
Yeah, yeah.
That's killer, and that's what youth ministry can become. It can buy into that message.
Yeah,
and that's why I think covenant theology is really good, where it says, look, there are no hoops for you to jump through to be part of our church. Yeah. Even accepting grace is not a hoop. Baptism is not a hoop.
Yeah.
It's not a performance. It is a response. It is an expression of what God is doing.
Mm-hmm.
And keeping that covenant theology to where belonging happens before even a decision to belong, per se, mm-hmm. I think is a very important message for students. And I think it's a biblical message, too.
Yeah, maybe, not to get political or anything here, but maybe that's what the psalmist meant when he said that I knew you in your mother's womb. You know, that God is always, you've always belonged to God in some way. Have you heard about this movie, Boyhood?
Yeah, I haven't seen it.
Okay, so I saw it this weekend.
I see it.
It's, but I'll just say that what you just described is shown incredibly poignantly well. So I think it's gotten a full release. For people who don't know, Boyhood's this film by Richard Linklater, you know, best known for Slacker and Before Sunset and movies like that. And he's a local guy here in Austin, so I don't know how big this is nationwide. But Linklater did something nobody's ever done before, which is he followed this kid and the same cast from 6 years old till 18, till he graduates high school. And what you see in that film, I think other movies and other things have like hinted at it, but what you see in his film is the extent to which his life is determined by adults that are trying to get their lives together, and the amount, what they really like, okay, that's normal. But what he really highlights without preaching about in this movie is how much pressure the kid feels. Like there are these moments where he can look at the adult and say, you know, I just want for 5 minutes somebody who's not bitching at me. I think that's kind of a trope I think a lot of teenagers would go to, but take it for as you will, how realistic the movie is. You know, when you see it in the movie, you get it. It really puts you in the kid's perspective. And it's like, man, everybody is riding this kid all day. And a lot of times, some of it's because they're adults that love the kid and they want his best interest. But a lot of times it's because they've got their own issues and they're taking it out on the kids.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, that's one of the things that Jeff Clark kind of revealed in Hurt, and then in Hurt 2.0, and then in Helping Hurt Kids and blah, 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 is that what we see, this systematic abandonment of adolescents from adults and from the adult culture. But the reason we see that abandonment is because the adult culture abandoned adolescents first and became present in their lives, but not present for the purpose of helping them achieve and grow, but present in almost just to make up for their mistakes.
Yeah.
And, you know, you talk about pressure. Modern Family did an episode like a year ago, and I may have talked about this on the podcast, but I don't remember, where Alex's mom, whatever the blonde girl's name is, Mrs. Dumphy, goes to like her physics class or whatever, and the teacher says snidingly, you know, we give our kids an hour and a half homework every day because we think that's what they can handle. And then the mom, in this very comedic moment, goes, yeah, but that's what all of the teachers say. It's like, if you give them an hour and a half homework, and then if she's got four other classes that give them an hour and a half homework, that's, and then she can't do basic math. But it, you know, it comes up to like, you know, it's like 7 hours of homework a night. And it's like, they get home at 3 or whatever, and they've been in school from 8 to 3, and then they've got 7 hours of homework. And it's a funny scene. But it's so true, because that's what so many of my students' lives are like, that they get home and they've got 6 or 7 hours of homework after already being in school. And that's not even on top of extracurricular activities and other things. And that's why youth ministry is really important, particularly when we're trying to avoid that earning treadmill that's been created, is that we give them a safe place to just exist and to rest. And the challenge is that they no longer value resting. And so things that are just like goofy, like going to a water world, water park places. Those are actually deeply theological moments, if only because it gives them a place to Sabbath and to enjoy and to not worry or be bothered by the ongoing trappings of everyday life and pressure.
Yeah, I can only imagine what it's like with the kids. I know where I'm at. We've said that Sabbath is one of our most core principles. Not because we see it all over the New Testament, not because it's a command for God, but because we either have to affirm or prophesy against our culture. Some things are good and should be affirmed. Some things should be stood up against. And I think that quite possibly the spiritual discipline which has the most power to shape the modern American, and it sounds like it's the same for the modern American teenager, is Sabbath, is carving out time to rest. So it sounds to me like that's a lot of what you're figuring out in youth ministry right now, is making it a space for that.
Yeah, if I do it well, which I sometimes do and sometimes don't.
Yeah.
You know, like Brueggemann just released the book Sabbath as Resistance or whatever.
Wow. What a title. Got some
really, I heard him speak at Pepperdine Lectureships, and he's got some really great things to say in that book, because I'm pretty sure the lecture was just the book in, you know, spoken form.
Well, that's saved me a couple of bucks. Hey, so last thing. What is one thing you want your kids that you're working with right now to walk away with?
I want them to know that the resurrection is changing things, and it changes us, and that Jesus is in fact coming. That who Jesus is what we center ourselves around. And when you center yourself around Jesus, you go above this cycle of earning and achieving, and your identity becomes centered on the cross and on the resurrection. And it's in those moments when you center yourself on Christ that you then are free to serve other people, and you're free to get out of the humdrum and to actually look to other people and care about their existence. Because for the most part, I think it's not that we're necessarily selfish. I think we are selfish, but we're selfish because we are finite people who want to survive.
Mm-hmm.
But when you realize that your life has greater purpose, your finiteness is no longer what you focus on, and your thriving and earning is no longer what you care for. What you care for is other people, because you know that your life is centered on something much bigger.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, no, if I were to recap, you would say that you're hoping that man, just so much of that teenageness that comes from that constant feeling like you have to look in can be overcome by looking at Jesus instead.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And if all of my students graduate and become some kind of missionary, domestic, foreign, whatever, then that would be the dream. That they wouldn't just go to college and get jobs, but they would go to college and get vocations.
Yeah. So I think we have a sign off now, right? We said we have a sign off.
I didn't think the random sound you make that makes you sound like a puppet.
Yeah, that's terrible. That's a terrible sign off. Well, this is Chris Morton.
And Kyle Sapp.
And we still don't have a sign off. So maybe join us next week or next time, whenever this goes, and we'll see if we'll have a sign off. But then.
May the force be with you, Gandalf.
Amen. All right.